Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Wing of Bond, specifically for your eyes only. Episode 103 of House Lights. I am here as Tristan Riddell, and with me, as always, are my illustrious co-hosts, the wonderful, young, blonde, and pigtailed John Mills, and the one man out there who is really concerned about his family and always wonders, what if he was a rich man? Darren Moser.
How are you guys doing today?
I'm still trying to figure out why General Veers has such a problem with Bond, honestly. Like, it's puzzling. this is the weirdest crossover I've ever seen in my life. So,
as soon as he pops on the screen, as soon as Julian Glover pops on the screen, you're like, you are going to stab Bond in the back. That is what you are going to do. I've seen The Last Crusade. Okay, I know how this is going to go down.
At least he has good taste in champagne and cars, though. You know, he has a Rolls Royce Phantom. That's a pretty cool car. So, you know, that works out.
So we are continuing on with our series on Bond, where we're taking a director's approach at Bond, where we did Goldfinger and what do we do? It was last week.
The Man with the Golden Gun.
The Man with the Golden Gun.
Both gold.
We did Goldfinger and The Man with the Golden Gun because they were directed by Guy Hamilton and their separate Bonds. This week, we are starting John Glenn, and this is his directorial debut with For Your Eyes Only. And next week, we are doing...
The Living Daylights,
which is also directed by John Glenn, but with the one and only Timothy Dalton. And so we're going to compare and contrast next week, but we'll talk about our findings with John Glenn this week and kind of talk about the differences in previous episodes. It's a whole spectrum of how directors are handling this character and how this actor is handling the material given to him. And so I'm excited to talk about this one because I have not seen this movie in a long time. And as I've talked about last week, Roger Moore is not my favorite. By far, he's not my favorite. But, there's a lot going on in this movie. There's a lot of set pieces. There are a lot of iconic action sequences. And so I think there's a lot to pull out. Even if there's a lot wrong with it, there's a lot to discuss of what is right and what doesn't work, what holds up, what doesn't. And so, Darren, I want to know from you, when was your first time watching this?
Oh, man. This was probably another blockbuster get. Another, checking it out. And there's always that Bond section of Blockbuster that had a bunch of the movies and maybe VCR, maybe on DVD. But I remember, probably just picking it up. I wouldn't say Moore is my favorite Bond, but I've always enjoyed his work, so it definitely would have turned me off to checking this out. But yeah, it's hard to put an actual date on it. So I'm going to guess late 90s, probably, was my first time watching this one.
John, how about you?
Well, this would be, I've told in the previous episodes how fellow Nerd Party member and host Sean Eastridge was my gateway to Bond. And I would say that For Your Eyes Only wound up in my second wave of Bond watching. Like, I went through and I hit the ones that I knew were the high points. And the way I approached Bond basically was I hit the high points, the stuff I knew was supposed to be good. And then I went and I jumped through and then I hit stuff that I had seen before that I knew was good. And then I started filling in the gaps. So this was wave two because I knew there were certain ones that should be put off until wave three. So this one, I wasn't told, no, no, wait until the end. I was told this one's okay to go ahead and work into that second wave and get a better, and actually it was cited as one to get a better feel for more as Bond, because between this and The Spy Who Loved Me, these are movies where Moore's charms get a chance to shine better in the role.
And I did choose to watch in sequence Spy Who Loved Me and then For Your Eyes Only, just, you know, to get a little more Moore. I know it's not covered in this exact comparison, but yeah, Spy Who Loved Me was a good chunk better than The Man with the Golden Gun. So, but this one was no slouch either. So it's going to be interesting.
And I note that you skipped Moonraker, which definitely was in my phase three of the Bond watching.
Moonraker's like firmly in the guilty pleasure, but it's, yeah, I don't know. I think it's all said in the fact that they're swinging so much from the fences. It's the plot is so over the top that they got to bring it back down to just to reality. And yeah. I think that's what we get a lot in Yours Eyes Only. We're not going to the moon. We're not going to Mars.
There's no laser space
battles.
What's
crazy is that Moonraker was such a huge financial success, which is insane to me.
It's weird. It's weird. It's absolutely weird because movies lived and died by word of mouth back then. I mean, they still do to an extent, but like, you know, streaming can abate some of that sort of thing. So Moonraker is pre-home video market. So I guess people just dug it back then. I don't know. You know, it was Studio 54 era. Maybe there was something in the air ducts. I don't know.
Well, you get Jaws, who you see return. And like we spoke last time with the choice of returning characters is sometimes not the best choice, but I think Jaws was a great return in For Your Eyes Only. He was, I think, very efficiently used.
They thought about bringing him back for this one. I'm not quite sure why they didn't. I just heard that they're like, it was discussed that they were just like, should we bring back Jaws? But actually no, wait, the reasoning was they wanted to go for a more serious tone with this one, which always makes me laugh.
Yeah,
that this is considered the serious Roger Moore James Bond film. The one where he fights, you know, hockey players in full gear.
But to Darren's point that he made earlier, this is a Bond who's brought back down to earth. Spy Who Loved Me, I think, is one of the greatest Bond movies. I adore that film. But you have a big underwater lair and the ship eating other ships and all of that sort of stuff, and, you know, oil tankers and all of that sort of thing. And then Moonraker, you literally go to space and have a laser battle, whereas this is a very believable spy mission of, we've lost a valuable piece of technology that we cannot afford to let the Soviets get their hands on because it will completely screw us. That is a real world mission where it's like, hey, yeah, you're gonna go out and no matter what, you're going to get this thing or you're going to die trying. Those are your two options right there. So this is definitely a, dare I say, this is bringing it back down to Goldfinger and then making it even more real world, because it's not a radiating gold. It's not some sort of wacky sort of plot. This is a From Russia with Love sort of thing where it is firmly, you believe that this is the type of mission somebody would be sent on.
Or even the modern Casino Royale. Like, modern Casino Royale, I would say, is also, it's the reset of Bond. It's like, we're going to bring it real back to just, he's a secret agent.
Yeah.
But it's not fantastical. And yeah, this one, yeah, like you said, I think you summed it up when you said, Bond fights people on a hockey rink. And it's like,
Which is so interesting, because I think that jumps us right into, you know, the fact that even though he's brought back down to earth, they're very conscious of the set pieces. They need to have those set pieces. And that is the one where if you came to me and you said, you have to decide some segment that you could literally just take a pair of scissors and cut out and nobody would know that it was in there to begin with, that right there. Like, it literally exists in this weird bubble that could be completely excised, and it would still make sense in the sequence of him going and talking at the hockey rink, getting rebuffed, and then walking out and finding out his driver's been killed. That makes right. perfect sense. There's no need for the hockey
you
players
need to
whatsoever.
Cut some time, yeah.
Yeah.
But you did make a solid point, though, about the previous installments, especially the last two previous installments, about how bringing it down to earth, like even if you have some ridiculousness in the film, the plot itself is very real world. And Darren, you mentioned, either John or Darren mentioned, that it was kind of a throwback to From Russia with Love. I would argue that it's kind of a combination of From Russia with Love and On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Mm. If anything, that might be to its detriment, where they went so far back to previous films that they kind of ripped off some plot points and set pieces from those two films.
Well, they rip off the skiing from The Spy Who Loved Me. In a sense, like, if you look at Roger Moore's Bond, they really fell in love with skiing.
That's
and
true.
I would argue that's because it's really easy to mask a stuntman in yeah. those things, because you can put a bunch of stuff on them and film at a distance, and people are going to just go with it, as opposed to something where you have to have, you know, say he's being driven around in an absolutely ridiculous helicopter hijacking, where he's very obviously hanging off from a rigging in front of a rear projection screen. You know, going yeah. around.
There was a lot of rear projection in this
whole
movie.
Lot.
I feel like the entire reason why Christopher Nolan had skiing in Inception was because of Roger Moore.
I'm sure of it.
Probably.
I'm sure of it. That would make sense. He's such a Bond fan. That totally makes sense.
It has to be, right? Well, now, I want to go back to John Glenn just a little bit. Not just a little bit. This whole thing's about John Glenn. But so he... This is his directorial debut, but he was an editor and second unit director on some major films. And like, he was an editor and second unit director on Bond films. I mean, he was the editor of Moonraker.
This is Step Up to Bat.
Loved Me.
Here we go.
Yeah. And On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And he was mainly a TV editor until he got to movies with Baby Love and On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And then when he was the second unit director or an assistant director on Moonraker and Superman in 78, and The Spy Who Loved Me, and On Her Majesty's Secret Service, and The Italian Job in 69. So, directorial debut, yes, but this guy is not inexperienced when he takes up the mantle of Bond director, and he directs all of the Bond films in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
So he directs five Bond films from 81 to
89.
Yeah. 89.
License to Kill, yeah.
And I mean, and that's just pretty cool to have that kind of continuity.
Yeah.
To have like an entire decade, like put your stamp on a decade of Bond.
And at a rate of one every 2 years, like clockwork. They could rely on him. They knew that Glenn was going to get the job done. That he was they were like, okay, they could set their release dates the way that Canon Films and later Marvel Studios would do, where they would just say, we're going to release on these dates and we have to have somebody who can manage the ship and get it across the line.
Right.
And the thing is, we've talked about this at the core. You know, you can talk about auteur, you can talk about artistic intent, you can talk about all of these sorts of things. But at the end of the day, a director has to be a good project manager and has to be somebody who can manage the production at ground level and make sure that you're getting all of the shots, that you're getting everything in place, that you can run the ship. And very obviously, Glenn can run the ship. Is that because he went through the Bond training program with those other two and he saw firsthand all of that type of stuff? And it would make sense to say, okay, we need another director, but we need somebody who understands it from the inside and what we're trying to go for and has been there for some of the success and for some of the failure. So who can we promote? And so it's promoting from within. Makes complete sense why he would wind up. And just given the fact that he gets, you know, successes there, yeah, you keep the guy on board. Like, if they had upset the apple cart, that's going to completely screw up their production schedule. So once he can demonstrate that he can get it done and have some sort of success, keep him in. Don't replace him.
I think that's what's amazing is, I mean, from 77 with The Spy Who Loved Me to License to Kill in 89, every 2 years you get a Bond movie, like mm-hmm. clockwork.
Yes.
And his directorial debut, his first Bond film, was a huge financial success and saved the production company because they bet on the wrong horse with a previous movie. And so when you're saving everybody's jobs they're going to be like, hey, maybe we should bring him back. You know, like, I think he knows what he's doing. It was kind of like David Yates with Harry Potter. Oh, I'm not saying that, like, WB was in financial trouble or anything like that, but it's just like they kept rotating directors, but then when they found David Yates, they're like, let's get him for a few more. You know what? Let's just keep this going.
Yeah, then you're not rolling the dice as much going forward.
Exactly. And didn't we get 5 Bond films with Guy Hamilton as well? I think we did, but he was clearly burnt out at the end.
Yes.
And there was so much behind the scenes drama.
And he had even, you know, he had ridden through the years, you know, you go Connery to Lazenby to Connery to Moore, whereas Glenn, and you could argue that this is possibly this idea of let's keep a winner in the seat, let's not upset the apple cart, that's acknowledged as something that kept Moore in the role, because Moore was just signing one movie extensions every single time. They kept intending to replace Moore, but because of the production schedule is one factor, but also because people still liked him as James Bond, they just stuck with it. They just kept saying, okay, let's keep him in.
Well, and I don't know like how long it takes to make a Bond movie, but you have to imagine they're just making them continuously, maybe a tiny bit of a respite in between movies. But every 2 years for this kind of movie with the location shooting, the effects, the, you know, the big budget kind of things we expect from a Bond movie, that's all you're doing. That's all Moore and Glenn are doing for like many years.
Also to keep in mind that probably what helps is what you'll notice starting from here forward, and Glenn undoubtedly has something to do with this because of the way the production schedule goes, they stopped trying to dream bigger in terms of the finale set pieces or the goal of Bond. Here it's getting the ATAC. In Octopussy, it's, you know, he's dressed up as Pagliacci crying the way the audience is, you know, trying to keep a nuclear bomb from going off. But it's a very tightly contained sort of finale. The stakes are huge, but it's contained. It's real world-ish type of stuff.
Because you can't keep one-upping. It's going to, I mean, I think Moonraker was that peak where they're like, okay, we got to back down because what can we possibly do to one-up that?
But the thing is, they do still keep doing big set pieces at the end. View to a Kill, he's fighting on top of the Golden Gate Bridge, but it's a close type of thing. It's not giant ships and giant spaceships and stuff like that. Right. It gets larger again with Living Daylights, but that's still some very manageable in the editing room plane stuff going on, as opposed to, again, you know, some of the stuff that went a bit off the rails in some of the earlier efforts.
Now, John, earlier you talked about how they kept thinking about replacing Moore, and Moore just kept doing one film extensions. That is partly shown at the very beginning of this film when he is at Bond's wife's grave.
Mm-hmm.
This was initially intended to be a bridge from a new younger Bond to the previous continuity, to kind of reinforce in the audience that this is the same person. Like, this is not that wackadoo 007 is a code name theory that people keep bringing up every couple of years, and I have no idea why, because they constantly prove it wrong. But what's crazy to me is, why include that scene when you have Roger Moore? Like, yeah, if you got Timothy Dalton like you wanted, do that. Because they end up doing that in the first, you know, Timothy Dalton film. They make a reference to his dead wife. But why do that with Roger Moore?
I can tell you why. Because the continuity is still worthwhile. Because of the fact that it was a different guy playing Bond, it still cements the idea that it's the same person, even though it's a different actor playing it. So it's still, I would argue, it still furthers that goal of tying the continuity together, no matter who's in that role. It establishes this is the same person you've been watching. You also have to keep in mind, again, this is before home video market explodes. So you have these little love marks in there to remind the audience, but also, what if this is some kid's first time seeing Bond in the theater and they've heard their dad talk about Bond, but they've never really seen a Bond movie? You immediately establish that Bond has been around for a while. Bond's wife died in the past, and this guy trying to kill him might have something to do with it. They don't really do a good job of establishing that. But for the longtime fans, oh, we know Blofeld is responsible for Bond's wife dying. So it makes sense that Blofeld, not Blofeld, is there.
Not Blofeld.
Yeah. What do you guys think of that opening? It almost feels like this is our last scene hurrah on kind of the Blofeld giant craziness, and then we're going to turn the page and just kind of mellow out, because we've talked about the cold open, as it were, of a Bond movie that has nothing to do with the plot of the main movie. But this one is different because it's so obvious, like, what they're implying on who it is, and then we don't actually see their face and all of that. Like, it's very, you know, George McFly nodded. But it's just an interesting beginning.
Well, I think you explained it. I mean, that is very much what it is. Like, it was there was a couple of references throughout this film that was kind of broadcasting to the audience that this is going to be a different movie. And this opening scene was also an FU to the person who sued, what was his name, McClory, who sued Eon for the rights to Blofeld. And he was the one who produced Never Say Never Again.
Right. And that's why they couldn't say Spectre. And that's right. That's where those whole rights issues came up. Mm. That's right. Yeah.
And so, yeah, they couldn't mention Blofeld as a character.
But we can basically imply kill Spectre. Him.
Yes. And so that was Broccoli's FU to McClory, saying, we don't need him. We're going to kill him right in the first minute of this new film. Like, we do not need Spectre. We don't need Blofeld. And we're going to move on. To me, I love the sequence. I think it's a great opening. I think it's really fun. Holy crap, that helicopter work was amazing. The forced perspective that they did for flying inside the warehouse was top notch. I thought it was tense. I love helicopter sequences in Bond films, and I loved picking them up. Which yeah. One of the feet? I don't know what they're called. And
the skids.
Skids. Thank you. I thought the whole sequence was fantastic. Like, he has to get out of the helicopter to get back in. Come on, that's a great action piece, but it's so totally different from the rest of the film, and it just doesn't fit. It feels like the right scene in the wrong movie.
I think it's like you said, though, it's the judgment kind of got overruled because this was their FU to this. Like, it really has nothing to do with anything except for we're going to include it and we're going to spend money on it because we want to make this kind of statement. And why not use the opening cold open of a Bond movie to do that? And why not? You can. There's nothing wrong with it. But it is, very, like you said, tonally very, very different than the whole rest of the movie.
Originally, the opening was supposed to be Melina's parents dying from the Cuban hitman on the boat. And then, so, you know, when we have that close-up.
Which we do see later, but.
Yes, we do. Yeah, we do see it later. But, like, in the movie, when you see that close-up of her, and then her, you know, her eyes are watered over, and then we have a quick cut. That was originally supposed to go right into the song.
Mm.
Arguably, it's a better open, but at the same time, and again, I'll fall back on that pre-home video sort of thing. Like, people have an expectation of what they're going to see when they sit down in that seat. What, like, everybody wants to see that thrilling open before the opening credits. And would that have been thrilling enough to have that assassination sequence? People also love to see Bond in that opening sequence. They're true. There, like, it's your little tease. It's like an overture to the symphony. Like, you have an expectation of that overture to get you in the mood.
The right? Man.
Here's the guy who can do the impossible thing, and he's going to get through this little 5-minute skit that shows exactly how fantastically capable he is, and then we're going to throw him into something, and you're going to be confident that he knows how to handle what he's doing, specifically because he's gotten away from this batch of bad guys, and these bad guys that he's conquering are such nothing for him. You know, we got to really throw the kitchen sink at him to get him through this sort of thing. And I think it's a winning formula. I do think it doesn't fit with the rest of the movie, and that is a problem in a tonal sense. But at the same time, I understand where you're leaning into an audience expectation of what's going on. They want to see Bond do the thing before the opening credits. And so it makes sense to put it in there.
And what's crazy, though, is that when you start with that sequence, but then go to the opening titles and then lead with the assassination, you can tell it's a tack on, because after the opening titles, we don't see Bond for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you had the assassination titles and then the ship going down, then we'd see Bond. So it's... Or wait. You know what I'm actually... I got my order.
Ship going down, assassination, yeah. Bond. Right. If we have that, you know, assassination in the beginning, or if we have ship going... I would argue that what should go before the credits is ship going down. For Your Eyes Only, assassination, Bond. That would make sense because that is still a thrilling opening. Bond's not in it, so you're rolling the dice a little bit, but it still puts it immediately throws the stakes at everybody and is a prologue that you don't have to waste. This is the weird thing, is I think the audience's mindset is such that they don't tack the prologue onto the running time. So if you had the ship going down before the opening credits, this movie could be 3 hours long and they would think it was 2 hours and 50 minutes long, because mentally you just don't consider that a part of the main plot necessarily. It's just flavoring for everything.
You know, talking about the ship going down, there's a lot of the Abyss parallels in this movie.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And it made me think of the opening of the Abyss, which is literally the Montana sub going down, and then they cut to the title card. And that would be the exact same thing. And I think the Abyss did it a little better with the submarine battle. I mean, obviously, it's probably like 7 years later. And James Cameron, who is the wizard of pushing the envelope. But I was like, man, there's a lot of similarities to this other movie that obviously came out later. But
well, I think that they both got inspiration from a real event that happened in 68. I do believe so. I do believe that that's the case. I could be wrong. I could be wrong. So with this film, there's a lot of characters. There is a lot of locations. There's a lot of bouncing around where you're like, okay, I found Christados. I found Brink. I found Locke. I found Kriegler. And now I found Columbo, and then BB's in the middle of it.
One more thing.
And one more thing, Melina. You know, like, it's just, there's so many different stages of Bond going from one place to the next, to the next, to the next. And I know that is a Bond structure. That is very much a Bond structure. It's just like, oh, I'm in Cuba, and then now I need to go to Italy, and now I need to go to Iceland.
The travel,
you know, absolutely. This one felt like it just amped it up to 11 with that. Am I alone in this, or did you guys read that as well?
No, he definitely is going around. Like, he's bouncing around. It's location, 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 location. He's all over the board so much that I'll totally cop to it. That there, like, when the dune buggy scene happens, I sit there and I'm like, wait, where are we again? What happened? Like, which country are we in right now? And I don't think that is to the benefit of any audience member to sit there and say, are we, you know, where am I? What's going on? I know what's happening on screen, but I've lost where I am in terms of, like, their location. Like, I couldn't put a pin on the map. I still couldn't tell you exactly where that beach was, you know, that sort of thing.
Oh, speaking of which, like, speaking of that beach scene and also the scene that came before it with the character of Liesl, I'm still trying. I cannot remember the point of her. And that's really sad that I cannot remember the point of that character.
To speak from a practical sense, it's because he's decent about the situation with BB, but Bond needs to be Bond. And so you need to have Liesl. And so that's sort of the point of the character, I would argue. You know, he needs to demonstrate that he's a ladies' man, but they... don't have him hook up with the woman who's 400 years younger than he is. So, you know, that's sort of those things. And that's the unfortunate thing.
She does fill that role. You can tell.
The unfortunate thing is,
why not have Melina fill that role? That's what's crazy.
Because she fills it at the end of the movie when he realizes she's really the one that he was most destined for or what have you. Because the whole idea that people don't want to admit that the whole point of these stories as he goes forward in each movie is, in the sense, it's very repetitive, but Bond finds his true match, his true mate by the end of the movie. And then, of course, we erase that by the time the next one comes around. It's like, oh, no, never mind. She was a double agent. She left my life. Ah, no, I can't be tied down. But when we leave the movie, we're supposed to feel like, you know what? Maybe Bond finally found the woman that can truly tame his heart and keep him in one spot.
I really dug, is it pronounced Bouquet? Carol Bouquet?
Yeah, I think so.
I really loved her performance as Melina, even though she was dubbed. I really dug her performance. I love her as a Bond girl. I think she's great. I love that she uses a crossbow. I think
that is pretty cool. That is pretty cool.
And that she's good with it, but like that's not her thing. Like she's like if what was her name? Tully in Goldfinger was actually a good shot.
Ah, yes. Right. Yes.
And I really, really liked her as a Bond girl. I think she was competent, but still, reliant on Bond. We got to talk about this. I know this is a common theme with Roger Moore and a common thing with, leading men all throughout Hollywood for the past century. But good Lord, Carol Bouquet, who played Melina, Lynn Holly Johnson, who played BB, are only months apart in age in real life. Mm-hmm. And they were 23 when this movie came out, and Roger Moore was 54. Carol Bouquet is closer to Roger Moore's age now than she was during filming.
I'm going to put this forward in the idea that Roger Moore was playing a role. And if you go back to live theater, they're John Barrymore days, right? Or some actor like that. Pull one out of the hat from 100 so years ago. They would...
Bing Crosby.
Well, not Bing Crosby. I'm talking about like live stage sort of thing where somebody would play Hamlet even though they were in their 50s sort of thing.
Sorry, I was just thinking about like White Christmas, about how he's like 40 years older than Rosemary.
Rosemary Clooney, yeah.
But I mean, that sort of gets to the point, but like... the actor was never seen by the audience as aging. It was all like, yes, we can look at it. And with open eyes, you're like, this guy's obviously way too old for these women. This is crazy. This is like Leonardo DiCaprio playing James Bond right now, but like, hey, oh, take that, Leo. But like you're looking at something where people aren't processing Bond, the character, as aging. It's that I forget, there was a specific name for it. I can't remember the word for it or something. But again, it really was. It was like somebody in their 50s playing Hamlet because they were the character. They were the actor who played Hamlet. So you paid the ticket so you could say that you saw them play Hamlet, even though Hamlet's a teenager, basically. But you got somebody in their 50s because you were paying the price for the ticket because that was Hamlet. And I think Roger Moore, to a lot of people, is Bond because of the specific era he was in. So nobody saw Roger Moore. Like, it's this weird sort of like cognitive dissonance that the audience can introduce where they don't see him as his age. They see him as the character and whatever age the character is supposed to be. I'm not trying to do
We know you're not condoning it, but I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but I mean, like,
Well, I don't think there's anything
about
to
condone or condemn. It's nothing about that.
Condone or not condemn. Yeah.
But like, while I might look at it now as a grown man with a family and be like, couldn't you recast this guy? At the same time, people wanted constancy. This was their escape. And, why upset the apple cart? And it's only 2-year increments. So as the audience is getting older, they're not necessarily seeing Bond as getting older. It was just 2 years ago, right? And it's sort of like that weird distortion that you have about your own age sometimes. So I'm just trying to posit sort of like the psychology going into why the audience didn't reject it sort of thing.
No, I get that. And it's just, I think we're only a few years away from A View to a Kill.
Yeah.
Because they come out with these every two years. And he's 58 in A View to a Kill. And I remember, like, people were talking about it then, where there's just like, okay, it's
so,
okay.
So somewhere between Your Eyes Only and A View to a Kill, it went over the hurdle of the mountain, and we're like, whoa, okay, now it's a little too much.
And that's the weird. That's the weird thing is once it happens, it's like, you know, everybody thinking Dick Clark doesn't age, and then all of a sudden everybody acknowledges that Dick Clark was way old, you know,
right?
That sort of thing.
And I know it's a bit hypocritical because we use kind of Roger Moore in A View to a Kill as a gold standard of it's time to retire, it's time to pass on the torch and everything like that. But like we have, and we're getting, you know, new jokes about Indiana Jones 5 and how, you know, how old Harrison Ford is and filming this. I mean, that just takes it to a brand new level. But at the same time, as a much more probably relevant and applicable comparison would be Tom Cruise in the Mission Impossible films. The dude is now 60 years old when Top Gun 2 came out, Maverick. And now, he's a freak of nature that has millions of dollars that he uses to rejuvenate his body, skin, and hair, and everything like that. He drinks the blood of pandas in order to, you know, make sure that he stays youthful. But that's crazy to me that he's 2 years older than Roger Moore was in A View to a Kill, but yet we continue to accept him as Ethan Hunt and not an aging person. But I think one thing that helps with that is that Jennifer Connelly in Top Gun 2 was 8 years his junior, not 35.
Right. And that's the mentality, I think, to speak to, you know, sort of the point that you made to kick this off, is that I think the casting now, people acknowledge 8 years is a more sensible difference than more than that.
My in-laws are 8 years apart.
Right. That makes sense. And in fact, to add on to the point that you're making, it was during A View to a Kill that apparently, maybe this is apocryphal, maybe it isn't, but I think this is a true story, is that Roger Moore had a moment that shocked him into realizing he really needed to stop doing this, because there's the femme fatale, the Bond girl in that one, and her mom was on set talking about how she grew up watching him, and he was like, oh boy, this is awkward. And he suddenly realized this was not really the thing he should be doing anymore. But the thing is, something I think actually helps Moore, specifically with this age difference thing, is Moore's own general charisma, and the guy just exuded decency about him. He really, on screen and off, Roger Moore seemed like the type of guy that was just a decent person. And so I honestly think that plugs into people's brains, as well as you're a little more forgiving, because you know that he's, if he had the opportunity, he'd break the fourth wall and look at the audience and be like, look, it's the script, okay? And you'd be like, yeah, I get it, Roger. Just keep going. It's fine.
I think there's often, like, reading behind the scenes stuff and reading, you know, tidbits here and there throughout the years, and interviews with Roger Moore and commentaries and things like that. Who knows if it's, you know, revisionist history on his part, but from what I've read from Roger Moore, so much of the stuff that I have not liked, or we have even not liked as a group, or people have not enjoyed about the directions that they have taken the Bond character through the Roger Moore years, he has not liked either, and has addressed and has voiced his concerns while they were filming or during the scripting process. And so much of that, I feel like if you listened to your star, I feel like so much could have been rectified. You dropped a joke about Leonardo DiCaprio, but I feel like the reason why Inception was not as crazy as it could have been is because Leonardo DiCaprio went to Chris Nolan and said, okay, I get you're excited, and the script is very complex, Mr. Nolan, but let's bring this down just a couple of notches so that people can actually understand it instead of watching it six times. And because he had that relationship with him, they were able to do it. And so many times I'm just like, I hear this after the fact, obviously decades after the fact, I'm just like, why didn't you listen to Roger Moore?
But I think that ties into the one film extension business, because it could be like, Roger's saying this about, yeah, we're going to fire him next time. Who cares? This is his last one. Who cares?
This is his last one.
We don't need to take his notes. And so then you come up to the next one and he's like, I say, John, we really need to talk about this scene on top of the Golden Gate Bridge. It's like, yeah, okay. And that one wound up being his last one. So they didn't need to take his notes. So there you go. It all worked out.
Darren, I have a question for you. You know, watching these so recently, you know, seeing a lot of Guy Hamilton, and then, you know, a Guy Hamilton, Roger Moore film, then directly going to the directorial debut of John Glenn with Roger Moore, did you see any stark differences between the performances, the direction, cinematography, style, whatever it is, like whatever you choose to see a difference between, did you see anything right away?
It's so hard because, I mean, we're picking like the hardest types of movies to do that for, because it's a Bond movie, which means you might change main actors, you might change directors. The story is completely different. Like, we know it's formulaic, which we like, but it's like, up to a point, Q is the only constant in like all of Bond, all the Bond
movies.
Desmond
Lewis, mm-hmm. Yeah.
They just keep
all the way
it
through
going.
Pierce Brosnan.
All the way through Pierce Brosnan, which is amazing. But I feel like the thing that changes the most to me is just the story, which I know is like obvious. I mean, that's obviously each movie is a different story, but this one, I will admit, like the middle act, I was zoning. Like it, I think maybe a little bit like we were talking about, there's a lot of locations and a lot of characters, and it kind of started to fall into that sci-fi trope of like, you know, we're going to go to this planet and get this person and then go to this planet. And it's like, I need a dictionary to keep up with what's going on. And I just felt disengaged of what is going on. I'm like, okay. And then it got me in the end. And once we started climbing the monastery and some of the other set pieces of the end, it swung back up again. But there was this lull in the middle where I was like, well, who's got to get the MacGuffin from the who and the where? And it was overtly complex. And I think Bond at its best is just simple, is just, again, we praise Goldfinger. Goldfinger is incredibly simple. It's, we know exactly what the bad guy wants. We figure out what's going to happen. He executes his plan. He literally almost gets away with it. Where this one was so much more of a, like, well, we got to find it, and then we got to get it, and who's going to go there, and then we got to get this. And then the death of her parents was almost a subplot. Like, we almost didn't even need that connection. Like, Bond doesn't care about her parents. He cares that she cares, but, you know, he's just doing his mission. And so, the change to Guy, I didn't notice anything big. But I kind of attribute that to, like we said before, he's a director from the Bond system. Even though this is his directorial debut, like he knows what pieces to include, and so it didn't feel very jarring. It just felt long.
I do agree. It felt long. I think that part of that is, I don't know if this is because it's Glenn's first time in the saddle and he's not really sure. But I mean, with his editing background, you'd think that he would have known where to trim and have that sense. Maybe he was just trusting his editor more.
Well, with so many pieces, though, it's kind of harder to edit, though. It's like you can't cut out when we went to X country and met so-and-so because they show up two scenes later.
Right,
and
you need
like
the bridge.
It's the episode one Phantom Menace problem where you have four finales going on that are all interwoven. You cannot cut one out.
Yeah.
And you know that Broccoli was just like, no. We spent $5 million on this setup and scene.
This ski sequence is going, you're keeping the jump in. Sure, you could cut around it and just go straight to the chase through the woods. You're keeping that jump in. We paid somebody a lot of money to do that thing.
Right.
Yes.
I was working on a short film. I was the I was an editor to come in and replace the first editor because the first editor wouldn't listen to the director. And because what happened was is that they paid a lot of money for a helicopter shot, and that was the first thing he cut out. He's just like, this is garbage. It doesn't make sense. You don't need it. He said, he's like, I spent a lot of money on that shot. Like, you like, this is a small indie film and we got this huge helicopter sequence. He's like, yeah, you spent your money on the wrong thing. It detracts from the story. And they fired him. And I'm like, oh, you're going to write me a paycheck? Sure. This shot goes in.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's a hard thing to do. Like, especially when you have producers breathing down your neck saying, no, we spent the money. We have to justify our
expenditures. There were no darlings killed in this movie, I doubt.
None. Yeah. Not a one. Yeah. And the thing is, probably what helps them is that they have a new director that he knows that he's got a color within the lines that they give.
And they make no tons choice. Of money. Like it works. It did it well. Worked. It's not like this was the flop that cemented Bond going on hiatus. That'd be later.
That's true. But what's interesting to me is that you wind up having another score that's not a John Barry score. You have Bill Conti in the composer seat. I got to know from you guys, okay? Do you have a lot of love for Conti? Do you like what he did with the score here? Or do you feel that maybe Conti is still a little too rooted in the 70s? Maybe he hasn't quite graduated to the fact that it's a new decade yet?
Yeah, this was this score really drew attention to itself, and not in a good way. Like, this was loud, this was brash, this was in your face, but it didn't give you the hook. There's a few subtle nods that I really enjoyed. Like, there's a few times then when Conti was playful with the theme, where you're just like, oh, you know, like that's the theme, like that's the theme of the region that they're in, like that's the tone of the region that they're in, and they're using the theme a little bit. I love it when Bond does that, but all the other times, it just felt like it was in your face. Am I alone in that, or?
No, I agree with you. This score feels like it doesn't belong. It feels odd, and the thing is, I hate saying that because I love Conti's work overall. I do think Conti generally hits the right notes, if you will, but it's really one of those things where I don't know why. I think it's because Bond is more seriously going after an actual real world thing I can believe a spy needs to go after to prevent the Russians from getting it, that the score seems out of place. This music feels like it's from the, I made the reference earlier too, the Studio 54 era. This belongs in the Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, you know, everybody's doing crazy sex things in a club late at night sort of music, as opposed to, wow, the world is on the line. If the Russians get this, we're all going to die sort of thing. Which actually brings me to, you know, I got to ask, because I'll be completely honest about it. I love the way Bond resolves it, everything at the end, where he throws the thing off the cliff, it smashes, and he says, neither side has it. It's detente. And the Russian general laughs and goes, okay, and just like walks off. And it's like, I love those sorts of moments. I mean, did you guys dig that? Or do you think that was anticlimactic?
I like the ending. I think there's good edited tension in his ascent up the rope. Like, that's a really well done sequence. I never feel like Bond's not in control, but he's got to push it. He's got to get up because the guy's hacking away at his mounts. But no, I like the ending of this. I kind of talked about the inverse bell curve of this movie, where it was like up and then down and then up again. You know, it ended on a high note. But I will concur with the score was not with nothing overwhelming. It didn't wow me.
But even having General Gogol come back is that, you know, Gogol is great continuity in and of itself. This is, he's the anti Sheriff J.W. Pepper character to bring back. Like, wow. This is a side character I don't mind seeing come back. That's a continuity character where I say, if you replace Bond but you keep Gogol the same, cool, I dig it. because this is a signal to me I should accept Bond as the same thing, because this side character I recognize is recognizing Bond as the same guy. Therefore, I will recognize Bond as the same guy. It's a very subtle but important nod, I think, that runs through everything from, I mean, when did Gogol first show up, for Pete's sake? I know he was in Spy Who Loved Me, but did he predate that for Bond movies? I don't think so. But
I'm not sure.
Either way, having Gogol run the gamut with Bond through, you know, Glenn's movies like that, I think is really, really important. I think is really good.
One thing I do want to mention, this is shifting gears just a little bit, but the actress who played Liesel, Cassandra Harris, she was married to Pierce Brosnan at the time. And she actually brought him on set and introduced him to some people. And I think Broccoli shook his hand and was just like, oh, okay. Like, this could work. This could work. And because Timothy Dalton, they wanted Timothy Dalton for this film, for Your Eyes Only, but he turned it down because of Moonraker. He's like, listen, I saw Moonraker. I'm not going to be associated with that. And then they went to Pierce Brosnan later, and Pierce Brosnan couldn't do it because of his commitment to Remington Steele. And so after Roger Moore bowed out, then we get Timothy Dalton, then we get Pierce Brosnan, and it's just really interesting that for at this time, they wanted those, like around this era, I should say. I shouldn't say
exactly
this
time. The future is kind of laid out. Movie. You know.
Yeah, the future is kind of laid out. And I always find that interesting that even though it's, you know, sometimes decades apart, there's like, hey, what's Pierce doing? What's going on with him?
Well, like, can we get him out of his contract?
You know. Well, I mean, you're also talking about this is the year to year or picture to picture deal era for Moore. So, of course, they're thinking about the future, because once he says no, like officially no, we got 2 years to make another movie with another person. We can't spend months finding our next Bond. We have to have him almost on deck.
Yes, absolutely. And it's fascinating to me in the sense that I can't help but wonder what these movies look like if they had gotten, you know, Dalton or Brosnan earlier. Like, does Spy Who Loved Me work better? Not Spy Who Loved Me, God forbid. But does For Your Eyes Only or Octopussy or View to a Kill work better with a different person as Bond? Or do we wind up with another Lazenby where those scripts are such garbage that you just say, no. You know, and he gets a mulligan, God bless you, you get to be a one-off Bond.
I think that is a great conversation to have next week when we talk about Timothy Dalton and John Glenn, and we can compare the two much more deftly. So how about we go ahead and get to our ratings? John, I would love to know what you rate this, because you gave the previous film, was it a 3 or 3.5?
It was a 3. There? But I readily admitted that it was a 3, powered largely by the fact that I thought that Count Dooku was such a great villain. And so, I'm sorry, Christopher Lee, that's what I meant. But I think that it is powered by that terrific villain that they have in Man with the Golden Gun. With this one, I think that this does have pacing issues. I think that there's some bloat. I think that there are some things that could be done differently. I would never, if I were trying to convince somebody to become a Bond fan, For Your Eyes Only would never be in that first batch of discs I give them. This is not an exciting Bond. This is not a thrilling Bond. And I want to be really generous with it. But at the end of the day, because of that rough patch in the beginning where it's like, not just the beginning, but throughout the movie where there are moments where it's like, this could have been cut. Oh, this scene could have been completely excised and I would have missed it. We didn't talk about this, but even though Alan Hume was director of photography on my beloved Return of the Jedi, I've never liked how he lights an indoor set that's supposed to be outside, because I think he's not particularly adept at making me think it's outside. And so there's some photography issues, I think, that occur in this, especially in that last sequence where they're going into the castle and everything. And I'm like, oh, that's an insert shot. I don't care for the score too much. I still enjoy it, but I would actually wind up giving it the same rating of 3 stars for Your Eyes Only.
Darren, how many bobsledders are you giving this film?
Yeah, I've been enjoying this rewatch of Bond, and it was probably to this film's detriment that I watched The Spy Who Loved Me right before it, because yes, that is an amazing Bond movie.
Yes, it is.
So comparatively, trying not to comparatively, this one I'm just going to give a 2. It's 80s Bond. It's a different shift.
Wait, you're giving this a 2. So you gave Golden Gun a 3, and yes, you're giving this a 2?
And we gave, and I told you, we got for Golden Gun, we had some, there's nostalgia. I've always liked The Man with the Golden Gun, Christopher Lee, all the same things. If you want to listen to our episode 102 podcast, we talked a lot about that. No, I know on paper, yeah, it does look, but I can't always compare to the other ratings of the other Bond movies. I have to almost look at the Bond movie on its own as a Bond movie, also as well as a Bond movie from John Glenn, which we'll get more in the comparison with next week. But as a Bond movie, I can't see myself ever rewatching this one. It was just not that I think they did pull it out of the end, and I think we had a great ending with some cool, you know, Bond set pieces, but I was so bored and disengaged in the middle of the plot. It was way too many characters and locations, and I needed that formulaic thread to pull me through. And maybe that's just the way I like watching Bond. I need, you know, my handheld a little bit more. But yeah, so I'm not saying I'm not able to do that comparison to, you know, why is this a 2 when Golden Gun was a 3 or Goldfinger is a 5. I almost have to look at each Bond movie, because like I said, there's so many factors that change. There's the directors and the who is Bond and the story and, you know, how much they dip into the formula, how many locations, what the big set pieces at the end. Like, there's this stew of pieces that come together, and it just didn't really do it for me. It honestly, watching this one and knowing that we have several more, you know, Roger Moore after this, like this, I could have seen this being his last one and being like, you know, we had mentioned before that he had played a role where he's like, oh, I'm too old for this, you know, my opposing Bond girl. And I almost thought that was this one with, you know, BB and some of the other motions. So I was almost surprised looking it up that he had a few more after this. Not that I don't think he's a good Bond. He is a good Bond, but, yeah, this one I can't see really watching again.
With me personally, I mean, I've already talked about what I like and what I don't like. I think this movie is a lot better than Golden Gun. I think the set pieces are great, but the problem is that just the set pieces are great. You know, it's there's so many of them that there doesn't feel like there's a through line with this movie. I don't feel invested. I don't feel like there's really too much at stake. I don't feel any drama. I don't feel any connection to the characters other than Melina at the beginning. I feel like they kind of ruin that goodwill as we go on, because it's just one after the other, one after the other, one after the other, one after the other. And I know that that's the formula of Bond, but you got to interject some reason for me to care. And I don't think this film did that. However, because this is such an improvement over Man with the Golden Gun, I can't give it the same kind of score. And I also, Darren, how you have nostalgia with Golden Gun, I have nostalgia towards this one, because this is probably the Roger Moore film that my dad and I watched together the most. Mm. And so I think about those moments, and I think about those crazy times and, you know, talking about it with my dad. And so I give this one a 3. Because I think John Glenn does a great job of directing the set pieces. I just feel like they needed an editor to and an understanding producer to kind of bring it down and cut it down. And like the stuff that they did with Carol Bouquet underwater, you know, she was never actually underwater.
Right. Try for
That's
wet.
Amazing. Yeah. They did such a great job of faking that. And like, I'm sure that like now that like once you know and you look for it and you like you really, really look for it, they're like, yes, you can tell, you know, it's 81 when it came out. But for the time and how they did it, and if no one told you that and you were just kind of watching it, you know, not looking for mistakes, they pulled it off really well. And so I think Roger Moore does a great Bond performance in this particular film. I think Carol Bouquet gives a great performance. And Lynn Holly Johnson's performance brings this down to a 3.
Wait a minute. Is anybody else confused as to why Warren Zevon is so mad at Bond? I don't know. I just want to throw that out there again. I just want to see if anybody was. Nothing. Nothing. Okay, sorry.
Nothing.
Nothing.
So there you have it, folks. That is our retro review, as it were, of For Your Eyes Only in the Wing of Bond. And we are going to continue to walk through the Wing of Bond. And please tune in next week as we talk about John Glenn, Timothy Dalton in The Living Daylights.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.